Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. On today's program, Star Trek technologies from Ohio State and Wright State Universities. Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson shares audio from the WISO archives, a 1975 in-studio interview with Maya Angelou. We'll also talk with Dayton City Manager Tim Reardon about economic efforts going on in the city. Up first, this past week, a federal judge ordered Ohio to reinstate early in-person voting the 3 days before Election Day. Earlier this year, Republican Secretary of State John Husted had directed the 88 county boards of elections to hold uniform voting hours, and they did not include the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before November's gubernatorial election. Democrats challenged that, saying it disproportionately affects their voters who dominate early in-person voting on those days. In a speech in Akron last week, Husted said his only concern had been uniformity. He said he'll follow the decision of U.S. District Judge Peter Economos, which gives Ohio the voting uniformity it needs. Ohio Democrats praised the decision. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is working with local governments, organizations, and businesses to collaborate in an effort to cut costs. Wright-Patt announced a number of new partnerships last week at a signing ceremony in Riverside. Xenia Mayor Marsha Bayless commented on the need for organizations to work together.
As I look at this partnership, it reminds me of my church, actually. My pastor has this saying that says we are companions and not competitors. And all of us are facing budget cuts, and so this is another very creative and productive way to share some of these resources.
Short-term projects include the launch of a regional workforce website to connect local talent with available jobs. Wright-Patt will also work with Sinclair Community College to provide firefighting and leadership training. The base is working to launch other long-term projects to share facilities and lower operational costs. Partners include the cities of Riverside, Xenia, and several universities. A case that tests how cities can use automated cameras to catch and find those who speed or run red lights went before the Ohio Supreme Court last week. State House correspondent Karen Kassler filed this report.
The case comes from a ticket that Bradley Walker of Kentucky got from an automated traffic camera when driving through Toledo in 2009. In 2011, he filed a lawsuit claiming that the process by which he would appeal the ticket was unconstitutional because the appeal didn't go to municipal court, which he claims has jurisdiction over traffic citations. Cities typically send a camera ticket appeal to an administrative hearing officer rather than into the court system, since the violation, they say, is civil, not criminal. And that's appropriate under Ohio's Constitution, says Adam Laux, who argued for the city of Toledo.
A principal part of that Constitution is the home rule authority of a city to self-govern. And a principal part of self-government, we submit, is the ability to set up administrative appeal boards to have quasi-judicial hearings on matters of local controversy.
Laux said if all disputes ended up in the courts, they'd be overwhelmed. So cities have set up administrative panels such as civil service commissions, tax appeals boards, even taxicab commissions, and dance hall review boards. And he said anyone who wants to appeal a traffic camera ticket can do so after they pay the fine. And if they don't like the hearing officer's decision, they can take it to court. Though he said that hasn't happened often. And that information about the court option usually does not accompany the ticket when it's sent to the driver in the mail. But Andrew Miley, representing the cited driver, Bradley Walker, argued that the administrative hearing process created by the Toledo Camera Program law is unconstitutional because state lawmakers have not allowed it.
The municipal court has jurisdiction unless the General Assembly says otherwise. Toledo cannot self-create an exception.
And Miley said drivers who don't want to pay the tickets while they appeal the violations could risk losing their cars because the law allows the city to act on those unpaid tickets as if they were debts. After the arguments, the attorneys for the city of Toledo and the camera operating company Redflix declined comment. But Maurice Thompson from the Libertarian 1851 Center for Constitutional Law was talking. He helped Bradley Walker's team, but for a bigger overall goal.
As a nominal legal matter, winning this case for us does not shut down the camera programs. What it means is that red light camera tickets have to go through the municipal court. Now, as a pragmatic economic matter, what that means is that it's no longer profitable and lucrative for cities to pursue those things.
And Bradley Walker was also there to see his case argued before the state's highest court.
kind of surprised that it went like it did. I will tell you that did I expect when we first started talking about what was there that we'd end up here today? I can't tell you that I ever believed that would be the case.
A previous Ohio Supreme Court decision ruled that cameras to catch speeders and red light runners are legal. It could be several months before ruling on the hearing process, which Thompson says is used by the 15 Ohio communities that have traffic cameras. Karen Kassler at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
Actress and civil rights activist Ruby Dee is being remembered for her devotion to the arts in her hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. As WKSU's Kabir Bhatia reports, Dee returned to act and teach acting many times until her death on Wednesday at age 91.
Ruby Dee was born in Cleveland and moved with her family to Harlem as a baby. Her debut on a Cleveland stage was at the Hannah Theater in a touring production of Anna Lucasta in the late 40s. Soon, she was on the silver screen in films like A Raisin in the Sun and The Jackie Robinson Story. But she often found time to return to Cleveland, both at Playhouse Square and at the Caramu House Theater, where artistic director Terrence Spivey worked with Dee twice.
So giving with the artists and so giving with me when I worked with her. She just wanted to be part of the ensemble. It wasn't about her being a legend or it was about, let me make sure I fit in with what you're doing here. I've told her, Miss D, 10% of you is 200% of anybody else. You know, I mean, she was just amazing.
Spivey says he'd discussed bringing D back to Cleveland in St. Lucie's Eyes, written specifically for the actress in 2002. Spivey now says he'd like to stage the piece as a tribute. In addition to being an Emmy and Grammy-winning performer, Dee and husband Ozzie Davis were friends of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., appearing with him at the March on Washington in 1963. Dee and Davis were married for 57 years until his death in 2005. They had three children together, including blues singer Guy Davis. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Kabir Bhatia.
Last Saturday, family and friends gathered in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to say goodbye to another American icon, Maya Angelou, who died last month at the age of 86. Rediscovered Radio's Jocelyn Robinson adds our remembrance today with an interview from the WYSO archives, recorded at our studio in 1975.
Maya Angelou wrote seven memoirs, poems, plays, two cookbooks, and countless words of inspiration. At Angelou's memorial service, First Lady Michelle Obama said, "She reminded us that we must each find our own voice, decide our own value, and then announce it to the world with all the pride and joy that is our birthright as members of the human race." When Maya Angelou came to Antioch College in June of 1975, she was already known for her words of resilience and uplift. Lynn Harris interviewed her for WYSO, and we share some of that conversation now.
When I'm asked, you know, how did you make it? An anthropologist or sociologist would look at my early life and say, I'm a born loser, have to be. Child of a broken family, raped at 7.5, growing up in poverty, black in the South without parents, direct parents. An unmarried mother at 16, it would seem that, you know, there's no way out. But I've had so many people be kind to me, and I've always recognized kindness, you know, mm-hmm. no matter how it might be shielded, you know, or tendered. So how then, except that I've had a lot of help, which immediately makes me responsible for being a lot of help. You see? Most people who write autobiographies are talking about facts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're informative. I'm trying to talk about the truth. What brought this about? What was the underlying, mm-hmm. you know, motive in this circumstance? Okay, it's true that you and I are sitting here, but there are those are facts. But your tiredness is a truth. Mine is a truth. The energy we're pulling up to get through this and still enjoy and be cheerful, those are the truths. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm about, and I hope to become great in it. By the fourth, fifth book, I should really have the form down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult for me to talk about the work because it's difficult to write it in the first place. In the first place, I have to almost enchant myself back to that time so that all the smells, all the background sounds, everything, all the textures are there. I'm there again. So I don't write it from a position of security and talk about it, and as told to, that sort of sense. And so I have to be there. And it's painful.
Did you write poetry before you began your autobiographies?
Yes, I wrote poetry from about 12 years old on. I've always tried to write it.
Mm-hmm.
I love poetry so, And I heard it in the black music and in the written poetry as well. But I loved the church songs and the blues because the lines are so pretty. I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone. No hope have I for tomorrow. I've started to make him my home.
Maya Angelou wrote her pain and her joy. To hear the entire interview, visit WYSO.org. For Rediscovered Radio, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Major funding for Rediscovered Radio is provided by the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. You're listening to WISO Weekend. Ohio is emerging as a global center of research in a branch of physics that's stymied scientists for decades. It's called terahertz radiation, a band of light waves with potential uses that range from detecting cancer to uncovering art forgeries. For Ohio Public Radio, WKSU's Jeff St. Clair reports on a Cleveland company's breakthrough in one of technology's final frontiers.
For those familiar with the original Star Trek series, this sound is unmistakable. It's a tricorder. Spock or McCoy could point it at anything and instantly know its chemical makeup, or see hidden objects, or diagnose diseases. A replica tricorder sits in the office of TerraPhysics founder and president Jerry Marini. As a fan of all things retro and a physicist and entrepreneur, Marini was inspired by the tricorder's pretend powers.
And so when we started working on terahertz devices, the first thing that came to my mind is we're building the world's first real-life Star Trek tricorder.
He says it may not be science fiction much longer.
We're not building the tricorder itself. We're building the engine that drives it.
The engine is a credit card-sized, high-power terahertz generator, technology that's eluded scientists since the 1960s. Marini offers to show me the clean room where it's made.
We're going to go in, right?
Okay.
If we're going in,
we have to suit up.
We have to suit up a little bit. It's not too bad.
Okay.
I need a hairnet, booties, the works. So while I'm suiting up, here's a little background on terahertz waves. Light is a spectrum. On one end, you have high-frequency X-rays. On the other, low-frequency radio waves, like the ones your radio antenna is capturing right now. In the middle of the spectrum is visible light that you're looking at right now. People have made use of practically every part of the spectrum in one way or another, except the terahertz frequencies. T-rays, as they're called, fall between the heavily utilized wavelengths of infrared radiation, think night vision goggles, and microwaves, think ovens or advanced radar. But the equally promising terahertz range has up until now been relatively inaccessible through existing technologies. That's called the terahertz gap.
I wouldn't describe it as a gap, but it is the spectral region which certainly has had the least attention, the fewest man years applied to it.
Frank DeLucia teaches physics at Ohio State University, and he is a pioneer in the field of terahertz research.
And so I think simply there are a lot more virgin territory here to explore and a lot more virgin things to find simply because it's not been worked on very much as a function of time. And part of the reason for that has been it has been difficult and expensive to build sources.
And DeLucia says the practical, portable terahertz source that Jerry Marini is about to show me is a significant jump forward.
So I'm going to zoom in on this thing.
Marini brings a small section of an inscribed slab of metal into focus.
It's a perfectly fabricated gold helix sitting on a very thin diamond sheet.
The gold coil is half as wide as a human hair. Marini says the tiny gold and diamond terahertz generator is based on decades-old technology married to today's nanofabrication techniques.
It's a vacuum tube, but a very modern-day vacuum tube, not unlike the glass vacuum tubes that are in my guitar amp at home. Just a much cooler one.
It took Marini and his team 10 years of long nights to get it to work, an event they quietly celebrated.
I have a bottle of 25-year-old Macallan Scotch in my office that I bought 7 years ago, and we went out there and opened it up.
TerraPhysics announced the breakthrough last month.
It's a paradigm shift.
Elliot Brown is an expert in terahertz technology at Wright State University in Dayton.
Because it would enable a whole class of new experiments that have not been conducted to date or have not been conducted well to date because of the lack of power in that frequency region.
Brown sees enormous potential for the TerraPhysics device, especially in biomedical imaging. In his lab, he uses T-rays to detect skin cancer, to diagnose burns, and to analyze DNA. In Cleveland, at TerraPhysics, Marini sees the potential of his device to identify chemicals, even at a distance.
In that frequency range, you can unambiguously identify molecular species because most molecular species in that frequency range exhibit what we refer to as resonant signatures.
The terahertz spectrum can also see through clothing and paper packaging. It's being tested in next-generation airport scanners to detect hidden objects or even the chemical signature of bomb material. T-rays are being used to link computer systems through high-bandwidth wireless, also in secure communications and data transfer. Other uses include inspection of paint and coatings, even uncovering art forgeries.
It's this unique area within the electromagnetic spectrum that, you know, shows so much enormous promise for so many different applications and really hasn't been tapped up until now.
The list of potential uses for terahertz devices sounds like science fiction, but one Cleveland company and researchers across Ohio may soon make them a reality. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Jeff St. Clair.
There's a lot going on in the city of Dayton, a lot of economic development efforts taking place, a push to bring more people into the city to live, work, or just play. On today's Why So Weekend, we speak with Dayton City Manager Tim Reardon about all this.
There's a couple things in terms of economic development. The Racino is being constructed north of downtown, and we think that'll end up having about 500 jobs. I think that'll be good. We've got an agreement that they'll hire about 30% of the people from within the city, so that'll be helpful. It means if people didn't have jobs, they'll be able to put money back into their houses. We think that's really good. And then in a recent announcement that PSA Airlines, which is the only airlines headquartered in the state of Ohio, is going to expand. They're part of the new US Air American Airlines that's been combined, and We have a hangar out there, and so they already are maintaining planes, which means if they're maintained overnight, they've got to fly someplace in the morning, and they want to fly with customers in it. So we're hoping that'll improve the destinations that we'll have. Now, that hasn't been announced yet, but we're hopeful on that. But the expansion is going to occur out at the airport.
The recent designation of Dayton, Cincinnati, and Northern Kentucky as a manufacturing community by the Obama administration is one of 12 communities nationwide. Were you involved in that project?
I was just involved on the periphery. That project is big. And I especially thought the leadership of the mayors of the two cities to indicate that these two regions can work together. And from there, I hope that other people in both Dayton and Cincinnati think, yes, we need a tie together. It gives us more buying power or more clout in terms of grants. I think that's where it'll be helpful, particularly. And I think both Dayton and Cincinnati have a long history of manufacturing. So the ability to have access to money, technical assistance, I think will be helpful for us.
As city manager, your purview is within the city of Dayton limits, correct?
Yes, I deal, you know, my job is to deal with services and issues within the Dayton city limits. I do think, though, that there are so many things that go on in the region that, for instance, I think I have good relationships with almost all the city managers in the region, and we do a lot of things where we work together and share. I think they've been supportive of a number of things within the city. I think it's a day and an era when everybody's being a little less provincial, and we're realizing that things have to grow at a regional level. This region, not just the city, was hit hard during the Great Recession, and the job losses really were every place. And so I think people share a common experience, and I think more and more, I think we all share a common destiny.
I think as an example of this, and I'm just curious if this is the case, that Dayton has done a lot of development along its waterfront. Miamisburg is working on their own efforts along their waterfront. Have they approached or talked to the city of Dayton for assistance on that?
Well, we actually have a designation for, I think it's 80-some miles of the Miami River and the riverfronts, working with the overall regional planning people and the Army Corps of Engineers. So, yes, we've been working together. I think it's a great partnership. Everybody loves the river. And, you know, this river was mean to us in 1913. And for a long time, the community turned its back on the river. You know, it's the evil river. And, of course, I think we all now realize what a great asset water and the river is. And I think you're seeing that all along the Miami River throughout this whole region.
Any current issues with waterfront development here in Dayton that you can tell us about?
Well, I think the Water Street project, which has both housing and it has 50,000 square feet of office, is one really big one. You'll see that we're doing a few things with the bikeway, making a few more entrances to the bikeway, and then we'll have the construction, and I forget, it's either this year or next year, on the kayaking rapids that's going to be down there by right in the downtown area. So those are three good examples of both development in the river and right next to the river.
What other initiatives are taking place to get people back to downtown Dayton, to get businesses, to bring residents back to the city, and even visitors? There's a lot going on.
In terms of downtown, what we're working with is existing buildings and places where there's land to either revitalize or rehabilitate an existing building and maybe convert it from office to residential. Or we're looking at some vacant land, which is the townhomes I talked about earlier, are on some vacant land that's getting developed. So we allocate a certain portion of our economic development pot each year to do things downtown, particularly some downtown housing. And so we're constantly working with people. There's some projects going on, but until we're ready to announce them, it's really too early to say things. But that's a real important priority for us, is to develop the housing downtown, attracting those people that I think, you know, the people that tend to come down tend to be very civically involved. We like that kind of people. So I think you'll just see more of that. This is really a phenomenon that's happening nationwide in terms of people like me that are empty nesters and younger people who want to be near where there's a lot of action and to be convenient where you can walk or have just a short drive to do the things you want. I mean, I love living downtown. It's just so convenient and it's central to everything. We walk a lot, so it's a great place. So I think there's just going to be a continuing market for downtown housing, and we want to be in a position of encouraging that.
As far as visitors to downtown are concerned, parking is typically mentioned as an issue. Do you think the city will ever do away with metered parking?
No, I don't think we'll do away with metered parking. Actually, the city has free parking on Saturday mornings. And as I said, I live downtown. And by 8:30 in the morning, all the parking spaces are occupied by the employees that are working downtown. So I have a harder time finding a parking space on Saturday morning than I do normally during the week. And that was the reason for parking meters. They're designed to turn over so that people can go in and out of a business, get lunch, and then come back and leave. So there's turnover in that. They're not designed for somebody to park there all day. So, no, I don't think there'll ever be a day when there'll be free parking.
All right. Let's talk about Welcome Dayton Initiative. It's been almost 3 years, I think, since that program was put in place. And I want your thoughts on how it's going and maybe some of the challenges that are still to be met.
Well, I love the Welcome Dayton program. I think it was really a very courageous decision that the city made. And for me, it was easier to make the recommendation. The city commissioners, the elected officials unanimously supported it. And what we always thought is the Welcome Dayton program isn't a magic cure that's going to happen in a week or a month, or it's not a single project. It's really changing the culture and the thinking pattern of our community. And I think the community is doing a nice job of that. We've asked a lot of the institutions to do little projects here and there to help out. The library, for instance, now has a lot more books in other languages. Hospitals spend a tremendous amount of money on translation services because there's a lot more immigrants coming into town. We're seeing landlords do a better job in terms of that. The police has changed some of its policies. And just the other day, we have a police officer, a tall young man, who speaks Arabic. And so for a significant population in our community, that's really good. When he goes to a crime scene and can talk the language with people, it just puts people at ease. And it's these kinds of things that we need to do more of. I mean, it's growing here, and I think we need to be more and more prepared. For instance, the Dayton Public Schools, the number of students who have English as a second language has increased from last year to this current school year that's completing by about 40% or more than 200 students. You know, we're going to have in this organization, the Chinese investors are doing this Fuyo plant that's going to be in Marin. And our community needs to do a welcome Fuyo here to make people welcome that they can come here and that they'll be treated well, because there's potentially a lot more investment that could come from China into the United States, which would mean more jobs for our people, more investment, and more wealth in our community, people benefiting from this. So I think we want to be a welcoming community, because it sends a message to people that, yes, this is where I'd like to invest.
Without taking too much more of your time, what are some of your biggest challenges as a city manager? What still needs work?
Well, we're going through a proposed redraft of our wellfield ordinance. It's an ordinance that's designed to protect our wellfields and protect our water system. And we're trying to create a little bit more flexibility than we've had for businesses to do some expansion. So there's a lot of discussions and hearings going on right now. We have people from both sides of the picture who have strong feelings, and we're trying to work something through on there. I always worry about the budget. You know, coming out of the recession has been a slow process for this region. We've not really bounced back strongly. So I always worry about that. Property taxes have been down. That's been a big challenge. I think there's an awful lot of good things going on downtown. Downtown looks really good. When I talk to people who come into town and see it, they feel really good about it. And so I think we need a couple of good hits there, and I think then we'd have the momentum to, have some really strong growth downtown. The CareSource people, which is probably one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing, large corporation in the region, is, they continued to lease another significant amount of square footage. So they've been growing and really doing well in terms of that. So I think those kinds of things just continue to strengthen the presence downtown. I think it's getting close to a tipping point to take off. Now, there's some people that leave, and that's sort of a normal process that you're going to have the ins and outs. But there are some really good things, and CareSource being particularly one that I'd like to highlight.
City of Dayton Manager Tim Reardon, thanks for your time.
It was good to speak to you. Thanks for having us, and pleased to be here.
Summer's hot in the Midwest, cold, my friend Kai home. Still calls Dayton home, even though.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up next, The Book Nook.
Dayton's been my best friend. Let's make